KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
And so what we are doing is we are creating an alternative to that path that exists now. And quite frankly, it'll be cheaper, faster, and easier to leave and wait 10 years than it will be to go through this process that we've designed.
By the 21st century, the Pacific Northwest has become home to some of the fastest growing and diverse South Asian communities in the nation.
I left Microsoft and started the Technology Access Foundation with my partner, with a very simple mission to bring technology to communities of color.
That's Trish Zico talking about the initial goal of the Technology Access Foundation. She's going to join us with an update. Amy Bott, co-author of Roots and Reflections, talking about South Asians in the Pacific Northwest. We're going to take a look at the roots of that community. And Marco Rubio talking about immigration reform, the senator from Florida, one of eight senators who are proposing a compromise overhaul of the broken immigration system. John McCain, Charles Schumer, above them, say that this is the first step in what will be a very difficult but achievable process to fix the nation's broken immigration system once and for all. Under the plan, among the things it recommends, the federal government could pump an additional $7 billion into securing the border with Mexico, extending that fence they've already started building. The nation's 11 million unauthorized immigrants could become U.S. citizens in 13 years or less, and it would overhaul the country's legal immigration system in ways that are only now being envisioned. President Obama liked the plan. He said it was a compromise. No one will get everything they wanted, including me, but it's largely consistent with the principles that I've repeatedly laid out for comprehensive reform. Matt Barreto is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Washington. He's director of the Washington Institute for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. He directs the Washington Poll. He works on the polling firm Latino Decisions, which he co-founded. I asked him for his assessment of this bill.
Well, I think that we have to keep in mind the comparison of the bill that the senators have introduced to what we have in the status quo. And the status quo situation is in terrible shape. There's no enforcement. There are people who are scared of picking their kids up at after school programs. And so I think as compared to what we have now, the Senate proposal is a huge improvement. That said, there are still lots of questions about what this path to citizenship will and look like, how many hurdles there are going to be, and a lot of other things. But it is a compromise bill. And it does address a lot of issues from conservatives. And I think that was inevitable, given that the Republicans continue to control the House. And so that's something that's going to be there from a starting point.
You sound like you're taking a hopeful approach to this bill.
Yeah, I think that, there's been a lot of efforts since 2006 when we saw the immigration rallies, including a very, very large one here in Seattle. There's been a lot of efforts to move immigration reform, and this is the closest that we've been. This is the closest we've seen a true bipartisan group of senators bringing forward this bill. And so I think that there are a lot of people that think this is a good starting point. Remember that this bill can be amended. It can be marked up a bit. Then there's going to be a House bill. And finally, there's going to have to be a conference with the White House, the House, and the Senate to agree on a final version. So there's still opportunities to change this. But I do think as a starting point that this marks a huge improvement over the immigration system we currently have and have had since 1986.
Matt Barreto teaches political science at the University of Washington, among his other hats. Also, the Washington Poll leader, director of the Washington Poll. Let me look at the security aspect of this for just a moment and get your impressions. Some of the details. Department of Homeland Security would have 6 months to develop a strategy to further secure the nation's southwest border, $3 billion to increase manpower and resources, National Guardsmen deployed to help build Border Patrol outposts, monitor the region, $1.5 billion to extend the existing fence across the 1,969 border. And then if after 5 years, if Homeland Security hasn't done what it was tasked to do, the whole Megillah is turned over to a Southern Border Commission, which is run by the governors of the southwestern states. Tell me what you think of the recipe there and what's being cooked up.
I think this is probably the most troubling or questionable aspect of the bill, and that is that the path to citizenship, the eligibility for legal permanent status, and ultimately a green card, appears to be contingent on this idea that the border will be 100% under surveillance and these other checkpoints that you just listed. These are very, very difficult markers to agree on. So even if progress is being made, I think a lot of people are worried that these are going to end up being political decisions. And there will always be people on the right who say, no, we need to do more. We need to add more border security. And so I think this is definitely the most troubling aspect. I think that people are going to be calling for independent and objective markers. Once a certain amount of money is spent, once a certain amount of fence is added, once a certain amount of surveillance is installed, then we should automatically see some of those triggers of the undocumented immigrants being able to move through the system. The biggest concern is that those folks who are here undocumented will be held hostage, essentially, to people like Arizona Governor Jan Brewer, who has a very negative track record on these issues. So I don't think that you want to give forward authority to those border governors. I don't think that makes sense. It doesn't then address the situation. It puts us back in a system where we still have 11 million people living here without the ability to work and the ability to live. So that, for me, is the thing that I have the most questions on, and I think a lot of people are going to want to see that addressed and really clarified for this bill to be successful.
And in terms of that path to citizenship, Matt Barreto, the immigrants, people who are in this country, could register as provisional immigrants if they entered before 2011. And they've been here all along. They pass a criminal background check, pay $500, and any outstanding taxes. And then they can renew that status 6 years later with another $500 payment. Does that get most everybody out of the underground?
It's going to probably affect, you know, upwards of 90 to 95% of the people who are here who are undocumented. Most immigrants have been here for a much longer time. They have very, very deep roots. We released a poll on Monday with Latino Decisions finding that among Latino undocumented immigrants, 85% have a family member in the U.S. who is a U.S. citizen, and that 68% of them have lived in the United States for over 10 years. So this is a community that's fairly established. For example, 62% have children who were born here in the U.S., so they're integrated into our schools, you know, high percentage are even homeowners. And so I think that those provisions are not going to ding a large number of people. Most people have been here a while. They're willing to pass background checks. They're willing to go through the system. As long as the fines and the fees are staggered, I think that that can work. You don't want to hit people up for $2,000 up front. That would be devastating. But as long as those fees are staggered. So I think it does address most. Certainly, you know, there are people that want to move that cutoff date up and forward. But the truth of the matter is we haven't seen a lot of undocumented immigrants entering or overstaying their visas in the last 2 to 3 years. Most of that population did arrive 10 years ago or more.
The move it up to 2012 or 2013, just as this moves through the democratic process, through the debate, it may stretch out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're going to see a lot of changes. The Senate bill, remember, is just a starting point. There's going to be people on both the left and the right, the House and the Senate, trying to move that. And I think you will see some changes to sort of clarify parts of the bill that we have right now, and just to make the bill smarter, to make it work. The last thing you want to do is introduce a bill and then millions and millions of immigrants decide, you know what, I'm not going to apply for that. I'm just going to stay in my current status because this seems too onerous. And so I think you will see some clarifications that do improve the bill.
We're talking with Matt Barreto. The other thing this bill tries to do is improve and clarify the immigration system in this country. It gets rid of the diversity option. It's going to and the practice of allowing U.S. citizens to petition for green cards for their siblings, creates a merit-based visa, 250,000 visas a year based on a point system, increases the cap on the H-1B visas, which a lot of people have argued for, getting more people who are educated in the sciences into the country, and 200,000 visas for W visas, so people work in retail, construction, hospitality, janitorial. I don't know where that works into agricultural work. Maybe you do, but how does this aspect of the bill play against your standards? How does it meet the standards you've put into place for good bills?
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things to remember is that you can't just increase border security and then provide legal status to undocumented immigrants without adjusting the legal immigration system. The reason that we're in this issue today, that we have a large number of undocumented immigrants living in the United States, is because the legal immigration system was not set up effectively. It wasn't set up effectively to meet the needs of employers across the different diverse industries that we have, whether we're talking about high-skill, high-education immigrants or service-level workers, janitorial and construction workers. The current visa system was just outdated. It was based on old expectations of our economy. And so it's very important that those things get adjusted and that we see both ends of them, that we see both on the high-skill, high-education end, but that we also see on the more service-level, lower-skill jobs, because it's important to provide people with a legal path to come and work in the United States, and that was lacking before. So it's very, very far-reaching in what it does and what it changes. And it also borrows some of those ideas from Governor Romney when he was talking about immigration reform, in saying that we should incentivize legal permanent status for some of those workers. And so it provides green cards to people with achieving master's or graduate degrees in the sciences and engineering to stay and live and work legally in the United States. So I think there's a lot of far-reaching reform on the legal immigration side to the visa program, and that's very important. If you don't adjust the visa program, 10 years from now, you're going to find yourself in a similar situation. People coming on a temporary two-year visa, deciding they like their job, and just staying here. Now, it's an important thing for people to remember that about 40% of undocumented immigrants are people who immigrated legally. They came with visas, but then they overstayed their visas. They just didn't get them properly renewed when the time had come. And so that's why a reform to the legal immigration side is also very, very critical.
All right, Professor Barreto, that was it sounds like you overall see a path moving forward with this bill for the first time in a long time.
Well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of criticism on all sides, but there's also a lot of hope. This is the first bill that we've seen that truly does have bipartisan support. It has the support of the president, and I think that that means that this is a really good starting point. We do need to make some amendments and some adjustments, but I think those will happen moving forward, and that the bottom line is that we have an opportunity to take these 11 million people who are living in fear of getting deported and getting separated from their families, and to provide them a path to that legal status and ultimately to citizenship. So it is a good starting point.
That's Matt Barreto, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Washington, Director of the Washington Institute for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. He directs the Washington Poll and the Latino Decisions Polling Group, talking about the eight senators who have come out with a bipartisan bill for immigration reform. President Obama called a reasonable compromise. He says it's consistent with the principles he's laid down for comprehensive reform as well. We'll see how that bill moves forward. This is Weekday.
Minutes past 9 o'clock. In a minute here, we're going to learn about some work that's being done with the aim of giving children of color equal opportunities. That's just ahead.
Support for KUOW comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
There's news this morning that a letter mailed to the White House has tested positive for ricin, which is a poison. Our partners at NPR are tracking this story, and we'll be getting updates from them through the morning and through the day as warranted.
Support for KUOW comes from the graduate programs of Seattle University, committed to providing professional education elevated by a social justice and leadership tradition. All 31 graduate programs and the School of Law host an open house on Friday, April 19th. Details at seattleu.edu/events.
49 degrees in Seattle, expecting a cloudy day with a high of 58. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:20. We'll explore the history of South Asian immigrants here in the Pacific Northwest in 20 minutes.
But first, we're going to talk about the Technology Access Foundation, or TAF, as it's known. A nonprofit providing science, technology, engineering, and math education, STEM education. Their program focuses on three problems that keep students of color away from those disciplines: low expectations, a shortage of role models, and lack of access to a quality STEM-focused education. Tris Zico has been working on that for well nigh 18 years now. She's co-founder and executive director of Technology Access Foundation, which I will call TAF just from now on. And she joins us in the studios. It's good to see you again.
Great to see you too. Thank you.
I would like you to start by telling me a little bit about the Bethode Community Center.
Yes. So this is our new home, and we have been working on this new home for 7 years. We opened in October of 2012, and it's really a hub for learning, for STEM learning, any kind of learning in the community, and it's the place where we're going to expand all of our programming and bring teachers in to learn how to deliver 21st century teaching and learning.
All your programs will be there? Will the school be there as well?
No, we only have one actual program there called STEM Up. It's our after-school program for middle school students. But we also have other nonprofits coming in and using the space to teach, as well as people coming in to have celebrations.
I looked at the picture of it on the website. It's a beautiful building.
It's an awesome building.
In Lakewood Park.
In Lakewood Park and White Center.
So it is named in part, you combine the names of two heroes. So for Ken Birdwell, who was a donor, it was Michael Faraday. Mm-hmm. And for you, it was Mary McLeod Bethune.
Yes.
Talk about her.
Well, you know, she is, to me, the ultimate in bringing education to the African-American community under dire circumstances. You know, she didn't stop. She kept doing her work, even though there were a lot of people pushing back on her. I really relate to her. And the work is still continuing, and we still need to keep doing that work. You know, we haven't arrived yet. She's a real hero for me.
She goes back to slavery times.
Yes.
Her parents were slaves, right? And she worked in the fields but saw the need and the ability mm-hmm. to pursue education.
And she's a good example of someone who was really smart but wasn't given credit for being smart because of who she was, you know, her socioeconomic background. And for me, and she knew that there were other African Americans that were smart and should have the opportunity for education, and saw that as a pathway to success. And it's the same way we view it at TAF. It's, you know, we have kids of color who are not getting the kind of education that they deserve, and the expectations are not held high for them. And we make a lot of assumptions as a society on what your ability is based off of your socioeconomic background.
I was watching the interview you did with our friend Eric Liu on yeah. Seattle Voices, and you talked about how there's a change from when you started to today, which is not just about access anymore, but about the expectation to be the creator and the person producing mm-hmm. the new information. And that's where you're taking your programs.
Yeah, so when we started, we really did intend for kids to be inventors and creators of technology, which is why we created the internship program and taught kids how to program and develop websites and manage networks. And we evolved over time as we started to look at our younger kids, our middle school kids. Of course, we couldn't really train them to work, so what could we do with them? We really focused on science and math for them, to make sure that they use technology in a way that helped them boost their science and math aptitude. And over the years, what we saw was these kids weren't getting anywhere near what we were giving them in their everyday schooling, and felt that it was time for us to change the organization and really focus on providing an academic environment where kids can learn day to day.
How many kids are you serving? And you have, and let's talk about three different programs, right?
Three different programs. So we have nearly 900 students in our programs this year. And we have our TAF Academy school. We have our Tech Start program has evolved into an in-school program where we provide a STEM teacher in the classroom with the classroom teacher 3 days a week, three classes a week.
Those are for what, K through five?
It's K through five. In Highline, it's K through six because they go up to sixth grade for elementary. And it's a new, we're in year three of it. It's a new way to do that program because TechStart was an after-school program. And we're getting great results being in the classroom with the kids. And the advantage we have right now is that we reach all kids, not just the kids who can come to the after-school program. You know, transportation is a really big challenge for us in after-school programming, as well as other nonprofits who do after-school work.
And then the TAF Academy is 6th through 12th.
6th through 12th grade.
And you're drawing
our first graduating class last year.
Yeah, I want to get to that. So you're drawing from Federal Way, Renton, Seattle school districts, on Highline school districts.
Yes.
So you had your first graduating class last year. What did you see?
Well, what we saw was first of all, it was a heavy lift for us in terms of making sure that every kid was graduating college ready. And
every kid's graduating college ready?
Yes.
How many kids are there, by the way, in that graduating class?
There were only 18. It was a small graduating
class. I'm sure
only
18 did not feel like only when you were doing it.
Yeah, it was a lot of work because, you know, we had kids that came into the school that we didn't have any experience with prior to them being in ninth. Some of them came in at 10th grade, some at 11th. And we had to work to get them college ready. And we always felt for us that success, the first level of success was getting them to graduate college ready and then getting them to college. We couldn't make them go to college, but at least we gave them the choice instead of saying, well, I got my high school diploma and I'm not ready for college, so I have to go do something else. We wanted them to be able to have the choice, and I believe we were very successful in that. But it opened our eyes to the fact that, you know, you really have to pay attention to kids every single year. The kids are different every year. You know, even your same set of kids, you know, they grow up and they have a different mindset. And so each year you have to look at your programming to decide what do you need to do to make sure these kids are successful this year.
Give me an example of maybe a class or a kid who went through that change and you were able to be nimble enough to offer him or her something different?
Well, we had a couple of young women who are twins, and they joined us as ninth graders, as special ed students.
Really?
And we successfully got them out of special ed and out of that designation and got both of them on the path to college. And one of the things that opened our eyes is that, you know, we knew that traditionally African-American and Latino kids get funneled into special ed just because sometimes, right? And there's no way for them to get out. And so our big focus was any kids that we had that were special ed kids, the number one thing we wanted to do is to get them out of special ed. Our project-based learning environment really supports that. And so it wasn't just the adults on the campus, it was also their peers that helped them get to that place.
So what's going on? You have kids who come in with low expectations,
yes,
who have had low expectations put on them. So they're all of a sudden in special ed.
Mm-hmm.
You and your staff know that they can rise higher.
Yes, we only have one track at TAF Academy, and that's college ready. So you can't come in and say, well, I want to take lower math, because there is no lower math, right?
So are you self-selecting for those kids who could not hack it with the higher math?
No, we're open. You know, we're open enrollment. All right. So the only thing you have to do is what you do with every other Federal Way public school is you sign the application. And basically that says what school you're coming from, and, you know, then you're in.
Trif Zico is co-founder and executive director of TAF. The TAF Academy in the Federal Way School District is a partnership, the only public school co-managed by a nonprofit and a school district. You alluded to something. I'm going to circle back around to being a co-manager, but you alluded to something. How long did you work at Microsoft?
8.5 years.
And you came from what college, what background did you come from?
I came from Monmouth College, degree in computer science, and I had 3 jobs before I came to Microsoft.
In the field?
In the field, yes.
You said you often were the only person of color looking around,
mm-hmm.
handful of women.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you keep your faith to move forward here and not get cynical or frustrated?
I grew up in a time, I was born in 1957, where I didn't have a lot of rights growing up. So it was just how you live, right? And you do everything you can to be successful.
Where were you born?
Belmar, New Jersey is where I was raised, yeah.
And where'd you go to school?
Monmouth College in New Jersey. It's now Monmouth University.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So you just had, you're like Ms. Bethune, right?
Yeah. It's the way you live. I mean, you don't just stop because people are holding you back, right? I think that what my generation failed to do with the kids of this generation is educate them on the fact that you do have to persevere. And you don't have a lot of choices sometimes as a person of color, depending on where you live. And you have to work twice as hard as the white kids sitting next to you.
At 18 years of doing TAF, mm-hmm. you have had to push hard, I imagine, on a resistant leadership, perhaps. What keeps them from seeing the argument that you're making, which is raise expectations, mm-hmm. have expectations for the kids, and they'll meet the challenge. What keeps them from that happening?
Well, first I'll say is that Federal Way Public Schools is not how you describe.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
they are a district. Yeah. Yeah, they are a district that is really pushing the envelope. You know, they started with alternative type schools. And then they rolled out the advanced learning program, where if you pass the state test, you're automatically enrolled in advanced learning, and you have to opt out. And then last year, they rolled out standards-based teaching and learning and standards-based grading. All those things we were a pilot for in some ways. But, you know, they're a brave district. They're the district that's saying, we need to go out and do things differently. It's going to take time. We're going to take hits for it, but we're going to move forward. And that all started with Tom Murphy and has continued now with Rob New as the superintendent. And that's really what it takes. I mean, we have an excellent relationship with Federal Way. They have allowed us to do some pretty innovative things and have supported us along the way and are learning some things from us as we are learning from them. And that's really what the partnership is about.
What are they learning from you folks?
I think what they're learning is that you can have a level, the teachers can have a level of freedom to create how they teach. You know, so there's a teacher on our campus who has an innovative method for teaching math, and the district has recognized that. And so we're working with them on helping other teachers teach in that way. Right. The whole idea of standards-based grading, you know, we started out that way. And so what they're seeing is it can be done at the middle and the high school level. It's already done at the elementary school level.
Define that for us, standards-based grade.
So basically it means that you can't get a grade for turning in your homework. It's about the content of the homework and that everything that you're assigned is mapped to a standard. And you are graded on how you perform, whether you meet it, you exceed it, you're approaching, or you're not even close.
How do you make that work under labor contracts? Is that a problem?
It's not a problem at all. It's just about how you teach, right? What needs to happen is our teaching colleges need to get in line so that when they produce teachers, that they know they can roll into the standards-based model. There are not a lot of districts that are doing this, but I think you don't have to wait for your district to roll it out. There's school by school it can be done. It's a lot more work for the teacher. And it's a lot more work for the whole teaching community in your school. But at the end of the day, what you get are kids who understand why it is they're learning what they're learning. They have multiple ways to demonstrate what they know. Right. And then, you know, the tests will just take care of themselves. Right. But really what is
it? You mean the required test?
Yeah, the required test. But really,
because they're learning to the standards.
Right. You know, there's no more extra points because you turn your homework in or taking tests again, you know, those kind of things, you know, and that gets you an A. It's about how you demonstrate what you know.
Tris Zico is our guest. So among your new tasks, let's touch the third rail here for a minute. You were recently appointed to the Washington State's new Charter School Commission.
Yes.
And you said it's met once.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have this because the Taft Academy is about the closest we have come in this state to a charter school before we legalized charter schools, because sure. You were a partnership, a nonprofit, and a school district. What do you want to bring to that conversation? Because the argument for charter schools is all about raising expectations, really, at its core, that every student should be treated as college bound.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So first I'll say that what I believe is that it doesn't matter what kind of school you have, charter, partner, public, private, if it doesn't work for kids, it doesn't matter that you pay $50,000 a year for it or whatever you pay for private school, right? It doesn't matter whether you got to choose to go to the charter school or that you were assigned to your public school. If the school does not work for the kids, if they haven't created the kind of academic environment where kids can be successful and adults can be successful, then it doesn't matter what you call it. What I bring to the table for the Charter Commission is we have created a school where the environment is designed for learning, for everybody to learn, not just having students sitting in cemetery rows and the teacher being the vessel of all information, but a place where we've created an environment where kids can guide their own learning, where teachers can develop and are encouraged to develop and want to. You know, so when you look at it, about 75% of the battle for us was finding the kind of staff that wanted to innovate. What I bring to the table is how do you work with that staff? How do you work with kids? How do you make sure you have this kind of environment where the expectations are high and there are resources to support it?
How did you find that staff?
It took us, you know, really the whole four out of the 5 years to really develop the kind of staff to fit the culture that we design, which is another important thing. You have to have a culture. You can't just let the culture evolve.
Well, you have been to enough public schools. You've worked Taft itself is working in public schools, mm-hmm. as well as yours is a public school. Students can sign up. They can mm-hmm. come just like any school.
Yeah.
Have you seen enough flexible public schools to know that, as you say, it's not the label, but it's... Mm-hmm.
I personally have not seen enough, and I think that we can do more. I believe as a state we can do more. You know, charters may be a vehicle, but, you know, it doesn't have to be that as a vehicle. I mean, what we really need are superintendents that are brave enough to step up and change the culture of their whole district and hire principals who are willing to set a culture for the school where they can bring in the right teachers for that school.
What's the language that a superintendent, when you hear a superintendent that has that knowledge, because mm-hmm. what I hear you saying is it starts at the top.
Starts at the top.
What's the language, what's the philosophy, how do they verbalize it that lets you know this is somebody who gets it?
I think that, you know, when you look at their actions, big or small, if they're focused on student achievement and not adult concerns. You know, so I'll go back to Federal Way. You know, the work that they've done recently is really all about how do we focus on kids and giving kids the things that they need, right? Giving them the opportunities that they need. Now, it took a while for them to get there because they had to create the right environment to make that happen. It doesn't mean that the environment is completely solid now. They're still working at it, but they're taking the hits and willing to do the work to make it happen. They're not folding under pressure. Right. That's the other thing is you can't fold under pressure. If you know what you're doing is right, you've got to stay focused. And, you know, the main thing is do no harm to kids. That's the focus.
Well, I mean, to look at the way education reform has unfolded in the state over the last 20 years, just as somebody who's covered it, it seems like whether they were right or wrong approaches, folding under pressure seems to have been what has occurred as people buffeted it back, questioned it. But you want to be on the right path.
You want to be on the right path. And there's a way to tell if you're on the right path. And you have to be nimble, right? So when I look at how we evolved TAF Academy and TechStart and StemUp, it's like, you know, we don't plan forever, right? We plan for a little bit, get going, and make sure that there are places where we can stop and say, is this working for kids? If it's not working for kids, we need to just stop it, right?
And you've done that.
And we've done that. We've done that. Every single year we've operated, we have done that. And it can be done. But you really have to have that singular focus on we're going to do what's right for kids and we're willing to accept adult casualties. And that's really what it's about. We're here to develop kids, which is a high-touch business. Education is a high-touch business. We can't do it on the cheap. We can't do it by plopping kids in front of a computer and letting the computer train them. You know, it has to be something where, particularly when you're working with low-income kids and kids of color, you know, you have to have relationships with kids.
Does TAF have the resources it has because you are able to get more money from private donors? Or are you funded the same way with the same amount of dollars as another Highline school?
So we're at the academy, we get the same per student funding, plus we add more on top of that because, you know, the per student funding is $4,852 is what we got last year per student from the state, which is very low.
When what you should think you be about getting? What
I think it should be twice that.
What do you add in?
So we add in another $4,000
and that's
per
from
kid.
Private sources?
That's from private sources. And, you know, so it takes a lot to raise that money to make it happen. And mostly it's because we're a STEM school, right? So we have to have equipment and things like that. But if we were not a STEM school, the biggest hit for us would be paying for professional development for the teachers, the academic support for the kids, the college readiness for the kids, and then keeping the class sizes small.
And what are the class sizes about?
We're at 50 kids per grade, no more than 25 kids in the class.
Do you think you could duplicate what you do around, replicate what you do around the state?
I know we can. I mean, the whole plan was to replicate, but what we need is the financial support to do it. You know, we need the support from donors. We need the support from grantors to go out there and to replicate this work. We are at a place right now where we're trying to expand. We get requests from around our state. We get requests from around the nation. You know, we just fielded a couple of conversations from folks in Detroit that want us to come out and do our programs in Detroit. And they're going to fund it. But, you know, when I look at that and I think, you know, somebody told me you're never a prophet in your own land. Right?
Yeah.
It's like we have the model that will work in multiple places. We can teach other people how to do it. We can roll it out ourselves. But really, we need the financial support to make it happen.
How healthy is your relationship with teachers unions?
It's very healthy. You know, what we're really doing is we're looking at helping teachers evolve their skills to a place where they can be successful with their kids, right? We provide a lot of support, leadership development, really getting them to knock out some of the issues themselves instead of us coming down with a hammer and saying, you will do this way. It's like, okay, here's a problem that we have. How are we going to solve this as a learning community? And give them the power to do it, because at the end of the day, they're the ones that are in front of the kids, not my staff. Right. They're the ones that are doing the work. They're the ones that have the relationship with the kids. They're the ones who are talking to the kids every day about how's life going at home, how's life going at school. You know, so they need to be the ones to solve the problems.
Trish DiZico is co-founder and executive director of TAF. She was also recently appointed to the new Charter School Commission in Washington State. I appreciate you talking to us. I hope we talk again.
Thank you very much.
This is Weekday.
Speaking of education, later today we'll look at the intersection of creativity and education. How important is creativity, and can it, should it be taught? That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which begins at 3 p.m. In the more immediate future, a look at the history of South Asian immigrants in the Pacific Northwest. That's just a minute away.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW-Bothell Technology MBA program and the Leadership MBA program at Bellevue, featuring small classes and interactive learning environments. Online application deadline is Monday, April 22nd. Details at uwb.edu/mba.
50 degrees in Seattle and partly cloudy. Forecast calls for mostly cloudy skies by afternoon and a high today of 58. Then rain overnight with a low of 43, and tomorrow Thursday windy and rainy with a high of 53.
Support for KUOW comes from City People's Gardens Design and Landscape, offering full garden design, installation, and maintenance services, specializing in creating functional, water-wise urban landscapes. More at citypeoples.com.
9:45. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A couple of Senate office buildings and parts of the U.S. Capitol building are being evacuated because of the discovery of two suspicious packages. We'll get a full update in our top-of-the-hour newscast, which is just about 15 minutes away.
Now we're going to turn to history and up to the present. While our perception of settlers and pioneers may hearken back to the horse and buggy, there were many people riding those horses and guiding those buggies. Amy Bott is Assistant Professor of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. Joins us in our studios. Good to see you.
Good morning.
And Lainey Iyer is Professor of English at Seattle University. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Together they have compiled Roots and Reflections, South Asians in the Pacific Northwest. And this is based on an oral history, number of oral histories that that people had compiled that you folks have used to put together a history that probably not a not well-known history of the Northwest, don't you think?
I think that's right. So this book is a collaboration between myself and Nalini, as well as the University of Washington Library's South Asian Oral History Project and the University of Washington Press. And in this collection, we're interested in thinking about how we can use the stories of contemporary immigrants to shed light on older histories of migration, as well as thinking about contemporary debates around immigration more generally. And we start really in the 1890s, thinking about the ways in which South Asian immigrants had started to come to the Pacific Northwest well before some of the later migrations that we see on the East Coast.
Yes, yeah, so we're coming full circle in these conversations from the beginning of the hour today. Define South Asians.
Well, it is a complicated term. And in general, we refer to people who come from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, Sri Lanka. So think east of Afghanistan, west of Burma, south of the Himalayas, more or less that would be South Asia.
Yeah, just a little part of the world population. Talk about these guys mm-hmm. in Bellingham. Who were they? When did they? How did they end up outside of Bellingham?
At the time, in the early 20th century, India, the whole Indian subcontinent, as everyone knows, was under British rule. And many of these men were agricultural workers from the Punjab region, which is divided today between India and Pakistan. And they came to the Pacific Northwest. Some of them had come as soldiers and such and gotten familiar with Canada and then migrated back here as a way of looking for work because conditions in India were bad and agricultural workers were struggling. So many families sent second or third sons abroad to look for work to support them. And so they came to Vancouver, which was because Canada was also part of the British Empire, easier for them to arrive. And then as opportunities opened up south of the border, they just crossed the border into Washington, Oregon, California, looking for work in the timber mills. So in Bellingham, they actually worked for the lumber mills predominantly.
How long were they there?
Well, not too long, because they started coming in, they were employed, they took lower wages than the white workers, and on Labor Day 1907, there was a huge riot where white workers had given an ultimatum to timber mill owners saying that you have to stop employing people at lower wages, and the mill owners didn't respond to the ultimatum, so the Bellingham workers came together and attacked the Indian, South Asian men who were living in barracks, broke down their homes, beat them up, threw out their belongings. And they they had no choice. The police chief stepped in to try and mitigate the situation. They rounded up all the South Asians, some 200 of them, and put them in the basement of the city hall, which was then the jail, for their quote-unquote protection. But even writers of the time thought that that protection might have been also an approach to making sure that the South Asians didn't rise back up in, you know, to respond in retaliation. The next morning, they were all rounded up. They were asked to pick up their belongings, and they were set on a train, and they headed out of town. They actually went further south, probably towards California and Oregon.
Mm-hmm. And did we lose track of them?
Of the particular individuals, probably, but as more of the folks started moving south, say down the I-5 corridor practically, some folks went to Astoria, Oregon, where there was, again, timber mill work. And at the time, they also started organizing against both British colonialism as well as racist immigration policies, and formed a political party called the Ghadar Party. Ghadar is in Urdu means revolution. And they rallied against British authority in India. And this organization, which actually played a pretty big role, a significant role, I would say, both in Asian South Asian immigration here as well as the anti-colonial struggles in India, formed amongst the timber workers in 1913 in Astoria, Oregon. And later, as people found work in California, the organization grew really strongly in Stockton.
You know, first of all, the first part of that story, of course, reminds us what happened to the Chinese workers around the same time, and what happened to African American workers across the history of the region. But that second part, the notion of them organizing here and reaching it all the way back through Canada, through Britain, to British India. Did you know that story before, Amy Bott? Had you known that?
Well, so I'd known about it in certain capacities. And the reason that the Pacific Northwest becomes such an important place in that is because partly of the role of the University of Washington. Here we actually had some of the oldest students coming from South Asia, in addition to the agricultural workers and lumber mill workers as well. And in particular, one figure, Tharak Nath Das, who ends up becoming a real leader of the Ghadar Party. He also published a newspaper called Free Hindustan, in which he collaborated with, interestingly enough, Irish nationalists that were also thinking about trying to figure out ways to create transnational communities to fight against British imperialism in the region at the same time. And so he ends up moving really all around the country, but had started at here with his PhD in political science and ended up completing it, I think, in Columbia, and then having this presence in New York. So you have this kind of interesting moment in the early 20th century here where the South Asian community is really being mobilized through these various factions of the working class, but then also these intellectuals that are coming here.
Yeah. Amy Bott is Assistant Professor of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. Nalini Iyer is Professor of English at Seattle University. Together, they put together Roots and Reflections, South Asians in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, there is this notion that South Asians in the Pacific Northwest came when Microsoft began. And this book is all about how that's not at all true. You have a picture of our friend Jeff Siddiqui in this book.
Yes.
Who used to be a commentator, still writes and calls us in. He's a writer in the area in the 70s. What's your history?
My history. So I grew up in southern India in the city that is now known as Chennai. When I was growing up, it was Madras. I came to graduate school at Purdue around the time I turned 21 for a master's in English, stayed on to get a PhD. And at the time, met a fellow graduate student, Ganesh. We got married. He got a job here in the biotech industry, and I followed, finished up my dissertation, and then got a job at Seattle University and established our lives here. So
did finding this oral history that was being done at the university and working on it, how did it change your perception of this region from when you first came?
I had glimmers of understanding that there had been some early 20th century migration and so forth, which I'd read off footnotes in books. But getting into the advisory board for the Oral History Project and then beginning on the work, working on the book project with Amy, we got to delve very deeply into academic publications on South Asian history, on the oral histories, on in literature, film, a variety of sources. And I understood how nuanced. So there's a lot of overlap with some aspects of my experience, but there are also lots of differences. And the ways in which people have navigated everyday life, there's a lot of bravery and courage in everyday life of the people. And I think that that sort of moved me and motivated me. And
Do your roots seem deeper because you know the history in the Northwest?
Yes, definitely. And furthermore, I have two children. And part of what motivated me to work on this project was that children of that generation, they don't know the stories of the people that they're surrounded by. And I think it's very important for that generation, of the second generation, to really not feel that everything is about a land our parents left behind, but they also need to know what's the story of their people in the land that they're growing up in. Mm-hmm.
What about your own, I guess, story, Amy Bott, because East Coast and West Coast, right?
Yeah. So I actually came to the University of Washington to do my PhD here in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies. And I started actually in a very sort of unglamorous way of being the transcriber of the first round of oral histories as a way to make a little extra money while in graduate school. And then eventually went through a couple of trainings through the MOHAI here in Seattle and became trained as the oral historian for the next phase of the collection of oral histories. So my connection to the project was actually from the inception of the collection here at the University of Washington Libraries.
Trained as the oral historian to help gather the information?
Exactly, yeah. So to actually do the interviews and to help with the recruitment and following up with narrators as they were crafting these stories, which are really stories that they've gifted to be archived at the University of Washington.
There are a lot of stories in this book and a lot of interesting people, and I'm not saying you have the best or the favorite, but among the heroes that you're the people that went through adversity, who stands out for you?
So my personal sort of favorite story is actually that of Dr. Sheila Kode. And I think the reason that I resonate so much with her story is because it in some ways mirrors the experience that my parents had, who migrated from India in the 1970s to Philadelphia. I came here to, of course, go to school, but they're still there on the East Coast. But in Dr. Cody's story, she was trained as a medical doctor at great expense and sacrifice of her family in Bombay. And she ended up coming here after marriage, only to find that her qualifications and credentials didn't transfer, and spent several years actually trying to navigate the system of credentialing to be able to start practicing eventually in the United States. And in that time period, she also started a family here and was also supporting her family still back in India. So working part-time in obesity clinics and running clinical trials when she had been sort of trained obstetrician and general practitioner in India. Eventually, she did this sort of rather unusual step and joined the United States Army as a physician. And she did this when she was 8 months pregnant with her second child.
What year was this?
This was in 1979.
Uh-huh.
And so she ended up joining the Army and recruited herself and ended up going through basic training and still actually works today in Fort Lewis as an Army physician. And what I love about her story is that she in some ways experienced downward class mobility when she came to the United States, which was similar for my parents who had been engineers in India and then came to the U.S. and had a hard time finding work in the same kind of industries that they had experienced there. And eventually they became small business owners and Dr. Kode kind of went this other route. But to me, it shows the ways in which immigration is not actually a clear path towards upward mobility and that it takes a lot of work, actually, to situate yourself here.
Yeah, a lot of work. That's Amy Bott. You have less time. Do you have a person who sticks out for you?
It's hard to pick, but I think I love the story of Raj Joshi. Raj and his wife, Irene Joshi, who was the former South Asia librarian at the University of Washington, they started the Oral History Project by donating money to the libraries to record the stories of those people who had come after World War II to the U.S., but before 1965 immigration laws. And not only the work that he and his wife did in the community, but the stories that Raj tells, the photographs, the manuscripts he translated and loaned us. All of this, he's such a fascinating figure with a remarkable history. You know, middle of his life, he quit and went to the Peace Corps for a couple of years and came back. The kinds of racism he struggled with in city work, working as an urban planner in the city, all of those. Those are elements of the story, and not only the courage, but also the joy with which he can look back on that history and share those stories with us. I think that was a remarkable one.
Yeah. I'm also struck by just the connections. We are also connected to each other through our families, but also through mm-hmm. our histories. Mm-hmm. Professor Amy Bhatt and Professor Nalini Iyer put together Roots and Reflections, wrote Roots and Reflections, South Asians in the Pacific Northwest. I appreciate you both talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
It's a weekday.
And now, the sound of the day.
Yes.
So Suzette was walking around San Francisco while on spring break and came across the street musician that you hear, his instrument, 5-gallon buckets and wine bottles. I see Bernard doing that sometimes in the studios. What interesting sounds are you hearing? Record 30 seconds, send it to us along with the story behind it. Put sound of the day in the email to weekday@kuow.org. Stay with us, more weekday to come.
9:59. Suspicious packages this morning in Washington, D.C. led to the at least partial evacuation of some Senate office buildings and parts of the U.S. Capitol building. The packages have now been removed and people are being let back inside. We'll get a full update on all this from NPR in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Service.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.